The tabloids love a scandal. If it involves the church, so much the better. It doesn't need much to make a story. Take a vicar, a congregation, sprinkle it with sex or dishonesty, simmer for a week, and you're in business. Whether it's true or not becomes, in a sense, secondary. It's a good story. And the world sits back, pleased with itself, saying, as I suspected, they're all a bunch of hypocrites and phonies. So whether it's a dishonest American televangelist or a way-out vicar in Sheffield, the essential impact is the same. It damages Christian integrity. I don't know about you, but I feel embarrassment, even pain, when these things get splashed all over the papers. Colleagues come up to me and say, see, one of your bunch is in a spot of bother again. And that sort of thing. And, you know, we laugh a bit, but it hurts as well. It shames us. It makes being a Christian harder for the rest of us. Scandal and smears have always been with us. It's always been like this in the Christian life. Paul knew that, and he knew how damaging for the gospel an unfounded smear campaign could be. For he was probably the victim of an unfounded smear campaign in Thessalonica after his ministry there. It seems that some people in Thessalonica were determined to discredit both his motives and his methods, and that they were slandering the man and his ministry. And he wants to respond. Not because he's on some sort of ego trip, but because he knows that if his ministry can be repudiated, then the very foundations of the church in Thessalonica and everywhere else that he's been can be undermined. For if the messenger is slighted, the message is slighted. Discredit the man, and you discredit the message. The gospel itself is at stake. If he is a fraud, the gospel may be a fraud. It's that serious. That's why over these two chapters of 1 Thessalonians, chapters 2 and 3, we find Paul writing very personally and passionately in defense of his ministry. We get a unique glimpse into his motives and his methods in evangelism, and into his pastoral heart. You see, in chapter 1, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, he's taken time and care to reassure the Thessalonians that they are an authentic church. But now in chapter 2, he's equally concerned to reassure them that he is an authentic minister, and to share with them some of what makes him tick. Now, it's not difficult to piece together some of the things that they were probably saying about Paul after the Thessalonian mission. His detractors in Thessalonica. He ran away, didn't he? He pushed off at night. He hasn't been seen since. He left you all high and dry. He's only in it for what he can get out of it. He doesn't really care about you because he hasn't been back since the mission. And all that must have hurt. And what we have in chapter 2, 1 to 12, is his reply, his defense, his argument for his case, not written like a sort of dull manual of pastoral care, but with all the passion and indignity of someone who's unjustly attacked, determined that other people should not be misled or dismayed or discouraged by what they hear. Here's not so much a sort of how-to manual, but here is something gleaned from the rough and tumble of the situation in which he found himself, a passionate concern to reassure his friends in Philippi that he was the genuine article, that he was a true evangelist and a real pastor. So here is a model for ministry. Here is evangelism at its best. Let's not say, just by way of introduction, well, I'm not a minister. I'm not an evangelist. I'm certainly not an apostle. There's nothing here for me. No. If you're a Christian, you're a minister. The New Testament says that in one sense at least, we're all ministers. The sense, the word is servant. We all have a ministry. Where's yours? For some people it's in the pulpit. For others it may be in a fellowship group or a flat or an office or a community. Where is yours? Test yourself, as I must test myself, by the marks and motivation of Paul's ministry as he argues them here. Well, he plunges straight in verses 1 and 2, with the first of what I've called authenticating signs of his Christian integrity. I've called it, one, courage, not fear. Courage, not fear. Thessalonica had not been easy. There had been, end of verse 2, strong opposition to his ministry. The last place, their last stop in Philippi, verse 2, had been even worse. That had ended in a riot. It had seen them stripped and beaten and thrown in prison. Their dignity and their civil rights were taken away, but their courage wasn't. And where we might have demanded a sabbatical, they're moving down the road, ready to get stuck in 25 or 30 miles away in Thessalonica. And there, verse 2, with the help of our God, we dared to tell you his gospel. Literally, we spoke freely, openly, fearlessly, with courage. How? With the help of God. Literally, in God. Why? Because of the importance of the message. It's his gospel. Do you see that? They were free from fear and confident in the message. They were open and they were bold. I wish I was. Sometimes, to my shame, I'm neither. I duck opportunities when they come because I'm afraid about upsetting people or embarrassing people or irritating people. The greatest fear that most of us face in Christian witness is the fear not of persecution, but of rejection, of being thought foolish or stupid or not accepted. It can paralyze us and imprison us in silence. Well, what keeps us going? What gives us the motivation to keep going? What kept Paul going? Because if we can discover what kept Paul going, it may help us to keep going too. It's what the RSV, perhaps in a way more vividly than the NIV, translates as courage in God. NIV says, help of our God. But the phrase is literally courage in God, an internal, supernatural conviction that ultimately what we're involved in is, in Christian witness, is God's work. That he can make it happen, that he can bring it about, that he can make us effective. You know, in various parts of the world today, people are being hurt for ministering the gospel. Good for us to reflect on that at times. It's a rebuke to our easy believism. It's a reminder that people are only prepared to suffer for what they believe. It's a stimulus to Christian courage. And Christian courage is an unmistakable mark of authentic ministry. Friends, we need to pray for courage. I need to pray for courage. And if you're like me, I suspect you do too. A second mark I've called truth, not tricks. Verse 3 and then verse 5. Verse 3, for the appeal we make, writes Paul, does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you. You see, we're not playing games in Christian ministry. Why? Because it involves the gospel. End of verse 2, as we saw, it's his gospel. God's gospel. And that point is underlined three times in the passage. It's the gospel of God. Verse 2, verse 8, and verse 9. The first truth you've got to get hold of about the gospel is that it's God's. That's the sole basis of its power and its validity. It's not of human origin. It's not something developed by people of religious genius. It's God's plan for human salvation. His way of bringing people into right relationship with himself and each other. Now that's both a great encouragement and a great relief. If it's God's, it's not ours to trim it or to change it. Our responsibility is like the postman's, to deliver it and not to tamper with it. In John Stott's memorable phrase, it is non-negotiable revelation from God. That's the gospel. That's what we're working with. That's what we're sharing with one another. You know, you wouldn't at times think that to look around the wider church and to hear some of the things that are said and taught and preached. The sort of, well, it's not quite our scene, old boy, kind of mentality. Or, that's not quite the way we do things here. You know, that attitude, in a sense, is incomprehensible. Is what we've received the gospel of God or not? It matters, vitally. Because if it is the gospel of God, we're not free to tamper with it. It's the truth. It's fixed. It's non-negotiable. The gospel is either true or it's not. Paul stakes his life on the truth of the gospel. You know, the first question we ask of anything today is not, is it true, but does it work? Now that might be a fair question, but the first test of the validity of the gospel is ultimately truth and not pragmatism. Paul's evangelism and ours needs to be deeply rooted in truth. And the moment we're preaching to attract an audience, or to create an impression, or to work up an atmosphere, or to present Christ as a sort of slick formula for success or happiness, or to play down the cost of discipleship, we move from truth to tricks. And Paul denounces that. He says it's not worthy of the gospel of God. His ministry, verse 3, was free from theological defects. But you know, it was also free from moral defects, uncleanness, impurity. NIV, impure motives. Do you see that? You see, we know from Acts 17, verse 4, that several prominent women were converted in that mission at Thessalonica. Not difficult to imagine the tabloids of the day getting to work on that, speculating darkly about religious groupies or cult prostitution. No, says Paul, our appeal did not spring from impure motives. There were no tricks. And of course, you know, impurity in ministry, in evangelism, is a much bigger thing than merely sex. Although sex and money are undoubtedly the longest running hits in the destruction of ministry. You see, in ministry, professional or lay, we can be greedy. Verse 5, greedy for all sorts of things, greedy for notice, greedy for power, greedy for glory, greedy for praise, greedy for numbers. And it's not just on money and sex that we get hung up. We specialize, verse 5, in the masks we use to conceal sometimes our true motivation. Note, you know, a minister's ego may actually be a bigger problem than his libido. But there's no room for complacency on either front, you know. And anybody involved in personal evangelism or pastoral ministry or counseling who thinks there's no risk of straying over into what one author calls the forbidden zone is a fool. So here then is the second authenticating mark of true ministry. Truth, not tricks. A true message, pure motives, open methods. The third mark I've called God, not men. Verses 4 to 6. God, not men. How do you guard yourself against these sort of dangers that we're talking about in evangelism or in pastoral ministry? What stands out so clearly in these few verses is that the key to effective ministry is God-centeredness. No secret of Christian ministry, writes John Stott, is more important than its fundamental God-centeredness. The effectiveness of any one of us in Christian ministry rises or falls according to the extent we seek to root our life and ministry in God. Ah, so simple in a sense. And yet it's so difficult. We do it for Him, not for men. Oh yes, we may have to be accountable to our minister, to a bishop, to church wardens, to a group leader. But ultimately, you know, we're accountable to God. And that's both frightening and it's liberating. It's frightening in that God sees us and knows us as we truly are. He sees through us. And He will one day hold us to account. And His standards are high. And how many of us could, like Paul, call in the press photographers and play the film back and say of our ministries and our motivation that, as he does, they've been pure? I suspect very few of us. But it's also liberating in that ultimately in ministry, which, you know, sadly is a world of endless criticism, ultimately we're not dependent on what others think of us. It's not other people's imperfect judgment which ultimately counts, but God's perfect judgment. And that's wonderfully liberating, because it means that ultimately we answer to Him and to Him alone. And that theological conviction can give us, as it gave Paul, an inner security and confidence. Look at the way he traces this through. Firstly, verse 4, God has approved him, tested him, found him fit for ministry. So to the critic who says, Paul, you're a con man, he can reply, but God has approved me. Secondly, as a result of this successful test, same verse, God has entrusted him with the gospel. So to the critic who says, Paul, you're in error, he replies, but I've been entrusted with God's gospel. Thirdly, to the critic who says, Paul, you're just a manipulator, a flatterer, a man-pleaser, he can reply, but I'm not trying to trick people. I'm trying to please God. And fourthly, end of verse 4, it is God who tests our hearts, not our human critics. So at every level, you see, ministry is to do with pleasing God. It's the ultimate motivation, but you know, it's also the ultimate defense. We spend far too long in the church criticizing one another and criticizing other churches. It's terribly destructive. At the end of the day, you know, God will determine the effectiveness of others in ministry, and He will determine our own effectiveness in ministry. For the moment, what matters supremely is that we are, verse 4, we dare to say, identifying with Paul, people approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. Well, I don't know about you, but that is more than enough to be getting on with. That sets the agenda, whatever else we think we should be doing. So courage, not fear, truth, not tricks, God, not men, authenticating marks from Paul of genuine ministry and effective evangelism. There's perhaps time for one more in our passage, and I've called it people, not perks. Verses 7 to 12. Very few people get involved in Christian service for the perks, because there aren't that many. Certainly nobody goes into the Church of England ordained ministry for the money, because the salary is fairly pathetic. In the first century it was worse again, and spiritual leaders like rabbis were expected to have a trade to keep themselves. Well, we know that Paul made tents. And in verse 9 he says, during his mission at Thessalonica, he worked night and day not to be a burden to anyone while we preach the gospel to you. You know, the perception that people are just in it for the money is one of the ugliest of all things you can say about anybody in their career or their profession. And, you know, it's ugly enough in any profession, but it's devastating in relation to the gospel. Weren't you ashamed of some of the antics and the lifestyle, the affluence of some of those TV evangelists in the States who were imprisoned and so on? You see, the Thessalonian tabloid said Paul was only in it for the money. But he replies here, you know, that's not true. It's simply not true. Yes, verse 7, as apostles, we could have been a burden to you. And there's a little play on words here. You know, it's because we're weighty people. We could have been a weight on you. That's the sort of sense. Here were big people, big personalities, important people arriving in Thessalonica. They could have expected the red carpet treatment. But what do we find? It's heads down. It's hard work all the way. Here were people entitled to honor and support, but they want nothing, nothing to be a stumbling block to the Thessalonians hearing and receiving the gospel. If Paul's ministry is, as we've seen, God-centered, then it's also people-orientated. And in two beautiful images in these last few verses in the section, he reinforces this emphasis. First of all, in verses 7 and 8, he has been, he says, gentle among them, like a mother to them, caring for her little children. And then in verses 9 to 12, he has been like a father, verse 11. So he compares himself to a mother and to a father. Mother, first of all, is this the Paul you know? Tough as old boots, and yet gentle as a mother. Concerned here not with power, but with care. More conscious of his responsibility than of his authority. You know, this is no new Islington man we're talking about here in the nurturing 90s. This is Paul. Paul the Apostle. And what does he say? Gentle, like a mother. Verse 8, loving you so much that we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well, because you had become so dear to us. You see, we can, and we probably should develop professional skills all we like in pastoral ministry, and it's good that we do, but at the end of the day, what distinguishes a competent minister from a great minister is a love for people. Love like this. Mother love. Love that's vulnerable. Identifying, nurturing, life-imparting, self-sacrificial. Think for a moment of some of the things mothers do. Think of some of the things they give up. Their time, their energy, their ambitions, their status, their goals, their sleep, their social life. You can lose all of those things as a mother if you're caring for children. Well, that's the pattern for Christian ministry, says Paul here. Children need to be fed and changed and watered, and when they get bigger, they need to be funded. They need to be scolded, encouraged, taught, cuddled, all those things. And mothers do all those and more. Homes, marriages, careers can all end up revolving around children. They make you laugh, they make you cry. They drive you round the bend. Well, that's what Christian ministry is like. That's how it gets to you. If you want a model for gospel ministry, says Paul, this is it. If you want a standard for post-mission follow-up, here it is. If you want a blueprint for pastoral care, then reflect on the love and self-sacrifice of a mother. But then secondly, he's a father too, a spiritual father. No one, not a father who just lobs the gospel grenades and then retreats to the bunkers. No, not a bit of it. Verse 11. This is an involved father, focusing on individuals. Look at that little phrase. Each of you, individuals mattered. And you know, if you go through the, the New Testament letters, you count up the number of people, the number of individuals that Paul was in touch with, it's something like 100 people. No, individuals mattered to Paul. Here he was, a father in God, encouraging, comforting, urging you to live, verse 11, lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory. And doing that, verse 10, by his example, holy living, And verse 11, by his words. Wise encouragement. For too many of us as parents, it's a case of do as I say and not as I do. But with Paul, his life and his words tell a consistent story. Well, it's a marvelous picture, isn't it, of effective pastoral ministry. And I'm convinced, you know, that we need Eugene Peterson's reminder that pastoring is not managing a religious business. No, it's running a spiritual family. And that can be untidy and at times painful. A lot of it is hard work, as Paul underlines in this passage. And there's no substitute for it. You know, I'm convinced that if we try to professionalize all pastoral care in the church, we run the risk of losing sight of the spontaneity and the simplicity of mother love, of father love. That ultimately those qualities are the ones we need most to show to one another. Those are the things that we need most to carry us through and to build us up. They are supremely the things, I suggest, that make the love of Christ real when we're hurting and challenging when we're complacent. And isn't it refreshing, too, that Paul shakes a few gender stereotypes for us in the process. So, you know, if there are any aspiring male macho Bible thumpers here, start working fast on prayer for some of these so-called feminine qualities like gentleness and patience and sympathy and tenderness, for your ministry will be lopsided without them. Well, let me end. Here is something of Paul's apologia for his Thessalonian ministry. He's defending himself. He's answering the groundless smears. He develops four authenticating marks of gospel ministry. Courage, not fear. Truth, not tricks. God, not men. And people, not perks. They remind us, don't they, of the urgent need for boldness, for integrity, for God-centeredness, and for love in all that we do in Christian service. Are you a minister? You are. Have you a ministry? You have. The question is, can we blend these themes into a life worthy of God, who calls us into his kingdom and glory? May he help each one of us to do so. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for the model that these verses give us of ministry. We want to pray that you will make us people who are bold, who have courage, who have integrity, who are God-centered, and who are loving like mothers and fathers. We ask these things for your name's sake. Amen.